It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. There's no question that Stanley Tucci is a gifted actor. Big Night, Devil Wears Prada, Hunger Games, Some Velvet Morning. He owns his roles, and he also owns the kitchen. He's a gifted cook. So what does food mean to him?
In a nutshell, it means everything. It just brings a great sensuality to life, and it's a creative act. You know, it's edible art. I mean, I suppose this is why the documentation of the recipes is so important. And maybe one of the reasons why, you know, we're obsessed with cooking shows now, because we want to preserve those things. We know that they dissipate, that they are ephemeral.
Stanley Tucci, The Thanksgiving Feast, and in this season of excess, a look at American food waste. That's this hour on The Splendid Table. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper. This holiday season, we're partnering with Feeding America to bring help to people who are hungry. Hunger happens in every community, rural or urban, and it impacts all of us. When you support The Splendid Table now, your gift will help provide meals to people in need through our partners at Feeding America and their network of local member food banks. Learn how to help at splendidtable.org/give. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. If you love film, you know Stanley Tucci is one of those actors who becomes the role. Remember his sinister character in The Lovely Bones, the bizarre chameleon host of The Hunger Games, not to mention the fashionista in The Devil Wears Prada, and of course, Paul Child in Julie and Julia. Now, if you're a film and a food lover, I'll bet the Tucci film that sealed the deal for you was Big Night. Well, since that film, Stanley's evolved into a serious and gifted cook, authored 2 cookbooks, and the latest is The Tucci Table, written with his wife, Felicity Blunt. We caught up with him in the green room of ABC's The Chew. Stanley, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Now, I have to make a confession.
Yes.
I cannot tell you what a fan I am.
Oh, thank you.
No, really. No. It all began with Big Night. And it wasn't just, I mean, I'm a cook, and I identified very strongly with the film, obviously. But it's also, I mean, I'm a sucker for a great cook who also has to be a great actor, and you are both. So there,
well,
now I've embarrassed myself.
No, not at all. I love it. Do it again.
All right, you've got it. No, but seriously, you know, in that film, there's a scene where you and your brother cook side by side, and I think you were doing frittatas, you know, with eggs. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing that and thinking, either somebody's really trained these guys, or there's instinct at work there. What did it take to do that scene?
Well, Tony and I both worked with different chefs, and I was lucky enough to meet Johnny Scapin, who really helped me a great deal. He allowed me to work in different stations in the kitchen at what was Le Madre, which was a wonderful restaurant in New York.
Oh, yeah.
Many years ago. So he helped make the pasta, helped make the gnocchi one day, helped do, you know, the salad station one day, and then peel the potatoes, peel the carrots, blah, 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 all that stuff. And the frittata was, because that was the end of the picture, when I just cooked that frittata in a master shot, it was very important that I really know how to do it well. So Johnny was kind enough to teach me how to do that, and then I just practiced over and over and over again.
But you've always cooked, right?
Yeah, I cooked, but it wasn't until after that movie that I really started to take a real, real interest in it.
So when the cooking really became serious, was it family food that you started working with?
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why the first cookbook exists. After Big Night, people said, oh, can you do a Big Night cookbook? And I said, well, you can't do a Big Night cookbook because there are no recipes in Big Night. There's really just the timpano, right, which is
right.
The centerpiece of the film. There's that and the frittata at the end. So the only thing that I could do was help facilitate putting together a cookbook for my parents and for Johnny Scapin, because he's Northern Italian, they're Southern Italian, and I thought that would be a great way to sort of, you know, explore that mm-hmm. in depth and also pass it on to other people, because it's really, I think those recipes are really, really important.
And those recipes are going away.
They are going away, and people, yeah, they are going away. And people, oh my God, sorry, Mario Batali just walked in, and then he just did. Thank you, yes, 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 thank you, goodbye. Out of his mind.
Yes, I know. I
yeah.
Know.
Oh, God. He smells good, though, doesn't he? What's he wearing? So, you know, getting those recipes out there was really important to me. And they are disappearing, and I think it's important to document them and pass them on.
Do you get a chance to do a lot of cooking at this point?
I cook constantly. When I'm home, I've been away for 2.5 weeks, so I haven't had a chance to cook, although I was at my parents' house, so I was able to cook a couple times with my mom, which was really great. But when I'm home, I cook every night.
What does food mean to you?
It means everything. In a nutshell, it means everything. It just brings a great sensuality to life, it's a creative act. But it's edible art. I like that.
Yeah, and it's ephemeral too.
Yeah. But I suppose this is why the documentation of the recipes is so important. And maybe one of the reasons why, you know, we're obsessed with cooking shows now, because we want to preserve those things. We know that they dissipate, that they are ephemeral.
Yeah.
But the real way to preserve it is, let's face it, is on paper.
True, but also to keep cooking it.
Yeah, to keep cooking it, exactly. Yeah.
Stanley, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm really, really flattered to be on your show. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
Take care.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Stanley Tucci is the author, with his wife Felicity Blunt, of The Tucci Table. Now, he left us with a recipe for vegetable parmigiana. Now, could any herbivore ask for a more delicious stand-in for a turkey? I don't think so. Find the recipe on the website, splendidtable.org. You got to get a kick out of all the big promises on the magazine racks right now. Now, if in fashion publications, the September issue is all, in food magazines, November is the trumpet fanfare of the year. And as for those promises, take Bon Appetit. Now, its November cover makes some big ones. For instance, tips for the best meal of the year. And the biggie, the turkey that is going to change your life. So how are they going to pull this off? Or should I say, how are they going to tell us to pull this off? Well, we have Adam Rappaport here. Now, he's the big decider, the guy commanding the desk where the proverbial buck stops. He's editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit. Adam, good to have you back with us.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
Okay, I've got to hear this. The turkey that's going to change my life. Tell all.
It's gonna make your life so much better, Lynn. This year, we're doing a spatchcocked turkey, which is essentially a butterfly turkey. If you ever have like chicken under a brick, that classic sort of Italian meal where you flatten out the chicken. We're basically doing the same thing, but with a much bigger bird. And what this allows you to do is, A, cook the turkey a lot quicker. Ours took about 90 minutes as opposed to about maybe up to
Whoa.
3 hours.
Yeah.
For about a 12 to 14 pound bird. And also you get that nice juicy breast meat with the crackling crisp skin without the breast meat drying out and whatnot. Because if a turkey's in there for 3 hours, as we all know, that breast meat can get kind of dry.
Yeah, that's a great idea too, because you're exposing all of the skin to the heat evenly. So I would imagine the skin becomes, well, to me, I have to say the best part of the turkey is
Lynn, I think we can all say that. Come on, let's be honest.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the best part of the turkey actually is the skin and then the gravy you make from all the drippings and the bones
here,
and whatnot. And as we put in this magazine, this issue, a good gravy will solve all your problems. If you have a great gravy, you can sort of ladle it on everything on your plate and everything is going to taste a lot better.
I think you're right. That's where the work really should be done. What is the secret for the great gravy for you?
Well, it's interesting. I learned this from my mom, from which I learned pretty much everything when it comes to food. I think a couple of things with gravy. You got to make a good stock, and that's something you could do a week ahead or a month ahead. You know, buy a bunch of turkey parts, make a basic mirepoix, chopped up vegetables, and just make a basic good stock. And you can even use chicken stock. That's all right. But if you make a turkey stock, even better, put it in the freezer and just put it away and wait for Thanksgiving Day. And then it's a matter of – the one thing about gravy is like – you can't do it in advance. You can make your stuffing in advance, your sweet potatoes, your mashed potatoes, all that sort of stuff. As the French would say, gravy is something you need to make à la minute. When the turkey is resting and on the cutting board, take all those drippings, you toast some flour in a pan, you pour in the fat to make a roux, which is basically just flour and whether it's butter or some sort of fat, so it gets that sort of like kind of caramelly brown color. And then you just start to whisk in the stock. And you get a beautiful, dark, rich, creamy gravy. And like I said, you take those drippings from the pan to sort of fortify it. And that's all you need. But it's something you have to make right before you sit down. And as we say, focus, like concentrate. Because if you screw up the gravy, you're going to have a lot of unhappy guests.
Yeah, one of the things you do, I think, in the menu, because you've got so many options in this menu you lay out. But one of the things I really like is all the sides can be done ahead. So you're not focusing on sides. You're focusing on bird just to make sure it's done right. And then you've got that gravy. But there's something else you mentioned, and I think this is one of the great traditions. Mashed potatoes.
Is there anything better? No.
No. But have you – is there any kind of new take on mashed potatoes or
– I think – I said I don't need newfangled mashed potatoes. I just need really good mashed potatoes. And it starts with the potato. And it was interesting. I was down in the test kitchen in July when we were testing all these recipes. And Dawn Perry, one of our test kitchen editors, was like, "Hey, Adam, taste these two mashed potatoes." And so I tasted the first one. It was kind of a light blonde color. And I'm like – that's pretty good. Tastes like my mom made. Tasted the second one, like a deeper yellow. And I was like, wow, that's really flavorful. Like, did you make these in chicken stock or something? Like, where does that richness come from? And Dawn said, no, no, no. The first one was russets, Idaho russet potatoes, your classic sort of baking potatoes.
Right,
second
right.
one, Yukon Gold. And good Yukon Golds just do have that richness, that almost kind of chickeny sort of flavor and a little bit of sweetness to them. And that just makes a huge difference. Start with the good potatoes. And when you're boiling the potatoes, another thing is you want to get rid of that excess moisture. And one thing I always love to do, after you strain the potatoes, put them back in the pot over a low flame and let all that steam and moisture escape from them for about a minute. And you're kind of stirring them around.
Right.
Because you don't want moisture from water. You want moisture from warm milk or cream and butter. And then you put them through a ricer or a food mill, stir in that butter and cream, get it just right, salt, pepper. And like I think that's all you need. Like if you want to, you can infuse it with a little – you can put some garlic cloves in the milk as you're warming it up on the stove, maybe some herbs. I don't think it needs it. You have so many other flavors going on your Thanksgiving plate.
Mm-hmm.
I like the purity of a mashed potatoes. And then one thing – a cool little trick that our test kitchen advises, say you make the mashed potatoes ahead. You've got them on the stovetop staying warm. What we recommend is before you drain that water out from the boiling potatoes, take a cupful of that starchy, rich potato water. And then when you're ready to serve the potatoes and you're warming them, just pour that in there. And it sort of like reconstitutes them. It gives them a nice moistness that they sort of lose if they've been sitting on the stove for an hour, even if not overheat, but just sitting there.
Right.
Stir it up and you're good to go.
That's a brilliant idea. Okay. There's something I have to take up with you, though.
Mm.
Because – desserts. You do not have a recipe for pumpkin pie.
Yeah, you know why, Lynn? Because you already have a recipe for pumpkin pie, and you like your pumpkin pie, and you don't need another recipe for pumpkin pie, and no one actually loves pumpkin pie. Everyone's like, yeah, it's good. I'll eat it because it's Thanksgiving, but you know what? I don't want to eat it. I'm done with pumpkin pie. I'm calling it right here.
You know, you're a guest right now, Adam, so I feel very guilty about taking you down on this.
Mm.
I like pumpkin pie.
Bring it on.
I like pumpkin pie in July. I think
you have never made a pumpkin pie in July. Stop.
All right, but I have made a pumpkin pie in March, and I have made a pumpkin pie in February, and I have made a pumpkin pie for Christmas. So,
really?
Yeah. Well, maybe there's three of us left in the country who really
exactly.
think pumpkin pie is fabulous.
When I was growing up, my mom made this wonderful pumpkin chiffon pie, which is like a pumpkin mousse with a graham cracker crust. That's another thing. When in doubt, graham cracker crust. Everyone loves a graham cracker crust. But think expansively about desserts. You don't need six pies on the sideboard. Why not have one pie, or we do this beautiful apple galette, like a free-form pie with a crispy, buttery, salty crust, and then, you know, apples are very in season. But then also we give recipes for these cool little custards, a little sort of nut, sort of chocolate tort, these cool little handmade jellies you can make. I always get annoyed when it's like I've got to take six really thin slices of six different pies and pile them onto my plate. And it's like that's kind of not how I want to eat dessert. Well, I've got a few opinions if you didn't notice.
I've noticed that. And with that, I want to wish you a very happy Thanksgiving without pumpkin pie.
Yes.
Hey, Adam, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Adam Rappaport is editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit magazine. Now, they've contributed to our Thanksgiving recipe collection. Check it out on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, Stump the Cook and a look at how we Americans waste food. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. The world sees us as the land of plenty, but we have a dirty, not so little secret. 41 million of us are hungry. Now add to that statistic $162 billion worth of food that we produce here isn't eaten. It's lost or it's wasted. That's one-third of all the food that is produced here in the United States. Well, this is where Elizabeth Reut comes in. She's an award-winning science and environment writer, author of, among other things, Garbage Lands, On the Secret Trail of Trash. And since we're kicking off the season of excess, I'm talking to her about her recent article in National Geographic, The High Cost of Food Waste. Elizabeth, good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here.
So, Elizabeth, could you begin where you began with the article in the Salinas Valley in California and the lettuce harvest?
Sure. I was in the Salinas Valley, which is the salad bowl of the nation, visiting grower packers. And after I had spent a couple of hours in the farm fields, I went on my own to the local transfer station and watched as all these trucks rolled in, dumping off giant loads of boxes and bags of lettuce, baby greens, spinaches. And I started talking to people there, and I learned that between April and November, this Solid Waste Authority landfills between 4 and 8 million pounds of these vegetables fresh from the fields. And they're in this pile because the boxes or bags had been improperly filled or labeled or sealed or cut.
So you mean all of that is going into the landfill and nobody's going to get a chance to eat it?
Not if it gets to this transfer station, no. These packer growers do donate an awful lot of food that they won't be able to sell to local food banks, but food banks can't always take all of this food. They've got restrictions on how much room they have. They don't all have refrigerated space.
Right.
So there's a lot of complicated logistical issues in moving edible food to people who are hungry and need it.
Now, if this, though, this kind of waste is coming out of errors in packaging, why can't the packagers correct those errors? Because they're wasting money.
I think that if they realize the error is happening on a grand enough scale, they would. But it's occasional. It's the beginning of the line that comes off a little crooked or the end of the line when they're switching roles, things
right.
like that. It is just – it takes too much time to stop the line and make an adjustment or open a bag and repack it. It
mm-hmm.
makes no economic sense to do right. this sort of small handwork when you look at the scale of the operation.
You know, I'm thinking of things a little closer to home, too, the supermarket. Now, we've been hearing a lot about how supermarkets have to pull perfectly edible food because of labels like sell by, best by, use by. I'm totally confused by these labels. What do they mean?
It is a very confusing situation. It's sort of a patchwork. It's not regulated on a federal level. The labels that say sell by were designed to help grocery managers rotate their stock. And the use by and best by more or less mean the same thing. They're indicators of peak freshness, but have nothing to do with the quality of the food and eating it the day after or a week after. The food may be perfectly healthy, but it does cause a lot of consumers to do these vast unnecessary purges from their refrigerators and their cabinets.
And, of course, the supermarkets have to do that same thing. And unless there is the food bank set up or, you know, some way that this goes to a secondary market or to people in need, it's wasted, right?
Right. Right. So food banks do get a lot of this close to expired food or even expired food. They understand that the food is still healthful and nutritious. So supermarkets move about 4 billion pounds of food out of from supermarkets and processors. So that is a great thing. But there is still a tremendous amount of food that just goes out into the dumpster behind the supermarket.
You had a figure in the article that the average American wastes 20 pounds of food a month? That's pretty stunning.
Yeah. I mean, if you ask anyone, do you waste food? They're going to say, no, I think I'm pretty good. But the garbage can doesn't lie. I learned this when I was reporting my book about garbage, when I quantified what was in there. But yeah, in a typical family of four, an American family of four, wastes 1,160 pounds of food a year, which is like throwing away $1,400.
And I think some of it is probably the kind of thing we don't think about, the doggy bag we took back from the restaurant and it ends up in the back of the fridge and you throw it away.
Right. Things get hidden in there. They get lost. We have a lot of great intentions. You know, we're told to eat a lot of fruits and vegetables, and this stuff is really seductive. There's a sort of biophilia. We want to buy it. We feel good about it. But then our plans change and we go out to eat and it gets lost in the back of the refrigerator. And another part of the problem is that we really pay no penalty or very little penalty for putting the stuff into the trash can. We don't realize what kind of environmental impact it will have downstream from us.
Now, this is where you get into the invisible sides of food waste. What are they?
Well, the most important thing is that there are a lot of hungry people out there, and we're producing a lot of food that isn't moving to these people. So that's paramount. But I'm also very concerned about the environmental impact of growing this food. It takes an enormous amount of resources. Some people have done research and found out that just to grow the food in the U.S. alone uses 70 times the amount of oil that was lost in the Deepwater Horizon blowout. And we use vast quantities of fresh water to grow this food. Agriculture is the largest user of fresh water in the country, in the world, actually. And we use chemical fertilizers and pesticides and then all this labor to grow food that, you know, 130 billion pounds of food that no one is even going to eat.
Oh, my. Elizabeth, thanks so much for talking with us. And it seems really appropriate to say happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you, Lynn, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Elizabeth Reut's article, The High Cost of Food Waste, was written for National Geographic. It is time to play Stump the Cook, the splendid table refrigerator game. Now, this is where a listener calls in with five ingredients that they really and truly have in their fridge, and I have to put them together into a dish that they would actually eat. USA Weekend has become a partner in this madness as they take that idea and turn it into a recipe with a photo that you can find monthly in the magazine and online. Now, this week's player is Shalon from Helena, Montana. Shalon, did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yes, you did. You did great.
Okay. All right, Shalon. What is in your refrigerator?
Okay. Amongst other things, we have duck fat, a whole young chicken.
Duck fat, whole young chicken. Yes.
Some tamarind paste.
Yes. All right. Yes.
And then we're going to get a little crazy with fermented black beans.
Ooh.
And lastly, some homemade fig jam that I made last fall.
Ooh. Oh, this is fabulous. Oh, this is just fabulous. Okay. I get free. All right.
Okay.
Salt, pepper, and water, and one kind of fat. But we've already got one kind of fat here. Okay.
Sure.
And I get to use three ingredients that you really have on hand.
Okay.
All right. Well, the first thing I'd like is garlic and a lot of it.
of course.
All right.
Plenty of that.
You've got vinegar?
Yes, lots of different kinds.
What kind have you got?
Well, you know, I've got your basic apple cider and white wine.
Right.
And, of course, the rice wine cooking vinegar.
The rice wine cooking vinegar. All right, let's keep it simple. Let's use cider vinegar. And then what I'd like with this are tomatoes.
Canned. I have cherry tomatoes.
Cherry tomatoes?
Or canned.
Or canned. Well, you know, I'm thinking canned.
Okay.
All right. Whole peeled tomatoes.
Okay.
A 15-ounce can.
I bet that I have that.
Okay. Yeah. So we've got vinegar. My three things are vinegar, garlic, and tomato. Okay. We're going to take that duck fat, a few tablespoons, put it in a big saute pan. Cut up the chicken into about 8 pieces and then grind over that chicken a lot of black pepper. Kind of rub it in. And then you're going to melt some of that duck fat in the bottom of this big straight-sided saute pan. So you just have a film of the duck fat. And you are going to slowly brown those chicken pieces until they are absolutely golden. You're going to start on skin side down. All right. And be careful to keep that skin intact. Okay. Meanwhile, heat up the oven to about 200 degrees. Now, you are going to take about 15 cloves of garlic and you're going to put 10 of them in that pan with the chicken that's already browned. You are going to sprinkle some salt over all of that because you're going to poach those garlic cloves with the chicken, okay? And then, well, how many did I say we needed? 15?
15.
I'd say let's go for 25.
Excellent.
All right. Now, the rest of those garlic cloves, you are going to cut in half. And those are going to go into the pan as well because once they're cut, you're releasing all that sulfur and whatever and you've got the stronger garlic flavor. Now you take about 3 tablespoons of tamarind paste, mix that with about a cup of water. You're going to chop a tablespoon and a half of the black beans, chop those fine. They get stirred in to the mixture of the tamarind. You are then going to add about a half a cup of the fig jam.
Ooh, excellent. Okay.
And then you're going to add about a cup of whole peeled tomatoes that you crush with your hands.
Okay.
All of that goes into the pan with that chicken that is now skin side up, browned and golden. And you want about 3 tablespoons of the vinegar in there.
Oh, of course. Okay.
Right? So you
get
a little acidity, a different kind of tartness than you get from the tamarind.
Yeah.
Cover the pan, and you are going to put it in a 200-degree oven for about 45 minutes to an hour, so it very, very, very slowly cooks, okay?
Yeah.
Let that cook until the chicken is almost falling off the bone. Pull it out of the oven. Now, be very careful of the pan handle. Lift the chicken out of the pan. You could put it on a bed of rice if you wanted to. And then you're going to boil down those pan juices until they're sticky and delicious, but don't burn them, and you're going to pour that over the chicken.
Oh, excellent. Oh, I can't wait to try this. This
and
is
you've
brilliant.
Got, yeah, this is going to be a tamarind fig jam chicken.
Okay.
Well, we should really say a garlic tamarind fig jam chicken. I think I win.
Yeah. You did great.
You know, in describing that, I have to say, I've done something similar, but not with the black beans. And I've got black beans. I'm going to try it with the black beans. I think that'll really
fun.
Be good. Hey, thanks for playing Stump the Cook.
Thank you, Lynn.
You take care.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You can find that recipe, sticky garlic tamarind fig jam chicken, in USA Weekend at usaweekend.com and, of course, at splendidtable.org. Now, if you want to play Stump the Cook, head to the website and shoot us a note. And with the holidays coming up, you can brush up on your manners as well with the podcast from the Emily Post Institute, Awesome Etiquette with Lizzie Post and Daniel Post Senning. Find it along with The Splendid Table, Dinner Party Download, and Big Appetites on our podcast network, infiniteguest.org.
Yeah. do some fixing in your kitchen. That's right, I said it looked like you need some fixing in your kitchen. I'm here to help you. Yes, indeed. Some fixing in your kitchen. I'm the one you're looking for.
We are talking to you this hour. Okay, let's get to your questions. Connect with us at 800-537-5252. And this is what Nina has done from Philadelphia. Nina, welcome. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. For the first time in 35 years, I'm not making Thanksgiving dinner. I'm doing a happy dance right now. Yeah, oh my goodness, I'm free. But I'm having an evening cocktail party and want to serve hors d'oeuvres that reflect the taste of Thanksgiving.
Oh, and, okay.
I'm very stumped on this.
Well,
I'd love to hear your ideas.
All right. Okay, a couple of things come to mind right off the top of my head. One is to cut either sweet potatoes or butternut squash or kombucha squash into cubes, bite-sized cubes. So they're about maybe 1-inch square cubes, mm-hmm. Okay? And toss that with olive oil, coarse salt, black pepper, a bit of cinnamon, and grated fresh ginger, and a little bit of sugar, and slow roast it in the oven at about 375 or 400 until they're soft. And then what you can do is either serve them warm or at room temperature. And what you do is you take a little bit of really good sharp cheddar, like just a little knob of it, and you take this and you put it on an attractive toothpick. And they're just, you just pop them in your mouth and pull them off that toothpick. And the contrast is just fabulous. And you can do the same idea, but with a very different cheese. Like, for instance, you can take grapes, again, very seasonal, right? You take grapes, you take them, and you put them on a pick with a little lump of blue cheese. Or if you want to get very fancy, this is an hors d'oeuvre that was the hottest thing that ever happened to New York in the 1970s. And it's a bit of work, but it's really, really fun. Half blue cheese, half cream cheese. Mash that all together. Throw in some minced scallion, okay, and a little bit of lemon. Mash that up. It's going to be – it should be thick and, you know, not runny at all. And then what you do is you pack that around grapes and you roll them in crushed pistachio nuts. And you put them in the fridge. They'll hold for a couple of days. Now, you will go insane doing that for a large cocktail party, but it is the most amazing thing. And it's finger food. And it's not sticky because you've got the ground nuts. Also, if you want to pull back a bit on the pistachios, you could roll them in parsley. So you see what I'm saying? It's really fabulous. Now, another great thing is hot sausages in a chafing dish that I've cut into, again, very simple bite-sized pieces, but I have cooked them in red wine. So I've actually cooked them in red wine until the red wine almost completely evaporates, and then they're browning in their own fat. And then I can just warm them up whenever I need them. Those can be done 2 days ahead. And then they just go on picks. Again, I'm a great fan of picks. And do if you want to, there are some really simple chicken liver pâtés out there where, you know, you sauté it, you throw in shallots and garlic and boil down some port, and you just puree that, and that is put in a crock and people just spread that on bread or on cucumber slices or that kind of thing. But do use organic chicken livers.
Can I use turkey liver?
Sure you can. You can use any kind of liver you'd like. I mean, you could use duck liver would be outrageous, and goose liver, of course. Well, that's going to get expensive. But there are some ideas. And then I know crudité is supposedly, you know, over. I'm sorry. You give me some fresh carrot and celery sticks that are cut in little stubs so I can do it in two bites, maybe with a little salt on them. I am over the moon. It's just clean.
Wonderful. Thank you. Happy holidays.
And you too. Have a great time. Take
care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
We're going to be back in a minute with more of your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, we're talking to you this hour. Connect with us at 800-537-5252. Get in touch on Facebook and Twitter, or shoot us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Okay, let's get back to your questions. We've got Jordan calling from Boston. Jordan, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
I will be spending Thanksgiving up in your area with my sister in Minneapolis, and we're the two big cooks of the family, and so we thought we'd try to spice things up a little bit. We're huge fans of French food, and we thought maybe if we could try to infuse some French ideas or French flavors into the traditional American Thanksgiving dinner, that might be fun. And so we're looking to keep with the classic dishes like your turkey, like your
pumpkin
and apple desserts. But we just kind of want to put a French twist on them and wanted to see if maybe you think that's a bad idea. But maybe also if you have any suggestions, we'd love to hear them.
Well, you know, there's a couple of ways you could go with this because it's still Thanksgiving. You know, the French love turkey. They eat turkey. But this is what I'm thinking. First of all, when it comes to the pumpkin dessert, and this is not new, but instead of doing the traditional pumpkin pie, how about doing a pumpkin mousse? And it could even be a frozen pumpkin mousse. Because what the blessing there is that you're probably flying in, but your sister could do it ahead.
Sure.
And it could be frozen in some sort of really sexy form, you know, some very decoratively. And then you can decorate it. Just do it even in a simple springform pan. Uh-huh. And then frost the sides of it with whipped cream and then press into that toasted almonds or slivered toasted hazelnuts, you know, toasted slivered almonds.
Right.
And or you could even frost it with something like a spiced whipped cream that has a little, just a few drops. Oh, wait a minute. Hold it. Back up. Okay. Take about a quarter cup of cognac and boil it down with a cinnamon stick and some allspice. And then a couple of tablespoons of that go into the whipped cream that frosts the outside.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, not too much because you don't want to liquefy the cream.
Okay.
And then you can imagine those toasted slivered almonds pressed in the side. So that's that's much more of a French approach than an Americana kind of approach. Also, what about starting off with a pâté?
Yeah.
And you could do
that.
Yeah, I mean, you could do a meat pâté. And if you go on our website, you know, splendidtable.org, there's recipes for meat pâtés.
Okay.
But there's also a recipe from Deborah Madison. It is a mushroom pâté. And it's a combination. You can use wild mushrooms, dried mushrooms, etc. And it's elegant as all get out. And it benefits from being done ahead.
Okay.
And you serve it in slices on individual plates. But the great thing I love about that kind of starter is you need to use none of the stove space. You can set it up fairly easily. And it has to wait at the table for a little while. It is not a big deal. So
my mouth is watering already.
And then the turkey, I always do this anyway. We call it an Italian turkey, but it could easily be French. No, but, you know, you do a combination of butter or olive oil and fresh herbs of thyme and rosemary and savory and basil and a little oregano. In so many words, the herb de Provence.
Right.
With the butter under the skin, but they're all fresh. A little lemon zest in there is kind of nice and perky.
Oh,
and
sure.
Then you slow roast the turkey and you baste it with white or red wine.
Mm.
And you make a delicious gravy with that and a little port added when you go to boil everything down in the roasting pan.
Okay.
You know, a little port first, just a small amount. You want that little hint of fruitiness. So, and that ends up tasting quite French.
Oh, wow. I cannot wait to try that all out. That is just the inspiration we were looking for. So wow. Thank you.
You are welcome, and have a great Thanksgiving.
Yeah, thanks so much, Lynn. Take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
That pâté, that mushroom pâté, check it out. It's on the website, and it's a Deborah Madison recipe. It's called Silky Mushroom Pâté. And it's a fabulous recipe. Takes a little time, but right now, perfect. A listener named Catherine sent us a great solution to how to chop onions without tears. She said she'd tried everything, and she came up with this super idea, which was putting a tea light next to the chopping board. Because what happens is onions, when you chop them, release sulfur, and that's why you tear. Well, that little burning tea light is going to burn off most of the sulfur. So she sent us even a picture. It shows that chopping board with her chopped onions and the tea light sitting next to it. Thank you, Catherine. Great idea. Really needed right now when we're doing all the cooking. Connect with us at 800-537-5252. Corey is on the line from Los Angeles. Hey, Corey, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I have this big olive tree. It's never bared fruit before, but this year, for the first time, it's just covered in these little black olives.
Ah, oh boy, you're lucky. This is fabulous.
They're a little bit bigger than Niçoise olives, but I'm not sure what kind of olives they are. And I was just wondering what to do with them, how to preserve them. I have no idea what to do with fresh olives.
Oh, boy, I haven't done this in ages, and I'm a little blurry on it. But this is generally what you do with olives. You know you can't eat them off the tree.
Yeah, no.
But this is what you do. You want to brine them or cure them in some way, and that can take weeks. And that's fine. But usually a brine process is water and salt. Now, there's a couple of websites, I think, that are going to be really helpful. Extra Virgin is one site that might be very helpful for you. This is by a man named, I think, Edward Mueller, if I remember correctly. And he does a whole critique of Italian olive oil, but in the process talks about curing olives, if I recall. But if you look up curing olives, generally it's a brining process or a salting process where they sit in a brine or just rubbed with a lot of salt, and they sit for quite a while, and then they are rinsed. And then if you want, they can actually be flavored, be tossed with olive oil and herbs and that kind of thing. But often they're just stored in a brine. And the brine can have flavoring in it, but if you want to taste the olive, so I'm not a fan of flavoring the brine. I just want to save the olives. I want them to cure. Because as the salt permeates the olive, what's happening too is the bitterness in the olive is starting to go away. And you want to do this before they're too ripe. So you're saying they're black at this point?
There's some green ones. There's plenty of green ones.
Okay. Then I think you want to pick them and you want to brine them just about right away.
Okay.
So I can't off the top of my head tell you the exact measurements. Often a brine is usually a gallon of water to, let's say, a cup to 2 cups of coarse sea salt or kosher salt. Don't use salt with iodine in it.
Okay.
Okay. But check it out. Epicurious would be a reliable source. The International Olive Association would be a reliable source. There is a California Olive Association that would also be a good source.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you so much.
You are welcome, and you're going to enjoy these. They're going to make great gifts.
Great.
Okay. Take care, Corey.
You too.
Bye. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org or check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Nicole in Cincinnati says that she and her mother are going a bit non-traditional this year for Thanksgiving. They're going to do turkey tacos. They've got a turkey breast, and it's going to be treated with a tequila lime marinade and roasted. And then she's got this amazing recipe for cranberry apple salsa using serrano peppers, cilantro, and lime. But what she's stuck about is, what else should I dress the tacos with? Well, first of all, you got a lot of flavors going on there. So I wonder if you shouldn't quit while you're ahead. But the one thing I think I would like with that is something really bright and fresh. And this may not be traditional, but I think it would really be a lovely touch, which is a little bit of shredded lettuce, just a small amount, and some diced onion. Could be red onion. And if you're concerned about that onion being super hot, what you can do is either put it in ice water or you can actually just sprinkle it with a bit of lime and let it sit for about 20 minutes. But that'll give that crunch and brightness and freshness to this combination. And I think it's a great idea. In fact, I think it's a really great idea and I may do a takeoff on it. Have a great holiday. And thanks for a great question. Call us, 800-537-5252. We have Kate calling from Oklahoma City. Hey, Kate, what do you want to talk about?
Well, my family and I are traveling for the Thanksgiving holiday, and I need to figure out the best way to get a good roast beef, either pre-cooked a little bit before we drive 8 hours, or transfer it refrigerated. We want to cook the meal in the home we are renting while we ski.
Right,
so
right.
I need some help.
Okay. How thick is the roast beef going to be?
You know, I don't know. It needs to serve 8 people, and I'm trying to decide if I want to do a rib roast or like a prime, like loin.
Okay. How much time will you have before you want to sit down and eat once you get there?
Oh, I'll have a full 24 hours.
They'll
get there on Wednesday.
Oh. All right. Then you want to transfer that baby as cold as you can get it.
Okay.
Yeah, because partially cooking and all that, you don't need to bother with that. And it doesn't do any favors for the meat. When you get there, make sure the refrigerator's cold. Keep it in the ice until the refrigerator's at least at something like 33 degrees, somewhere around there. And put it in the fridge. Now, what I like to do the night before is flavor the meat a little bit. And this is just an option. And that is I take a paring knife and I just poke long, you know, holes into the roast beef and then take a seasoned mixture. So if I'm feeling very Asian, it might be a little bit of soy sauce and some sugar and garlic and a fresh ginger. Or if I'm going Southeast Asian, you know, it might be things like chili and fresh mint or fresh coriander, garlic, and a little bit of fish sauce, which is the salt, essentially.
Right. But what would you recommend for my husband's best friend that we're traveling with is English, and he will be making Yorkshire pudding.
So all right. Okay. Then this is what I would do is this. I would season it. He might feel that seasoning it is not the proper thing to do, but I think it would be great. Make this ahead and keep it cold, okay? Puree together several cloves of garlic.
Okay.
And you want parsley, okay, a generous amount of parsley. So let's say you've got, 3 cloves of garlic. You want to tightly stuff washed and dried parsley leaves into a third of a cup, okay?
Right.
And you want some about, I'd say maybe 3 to 4 tablespoons of olive oil and about the same amount of red wine. And you puree that together in, you know, a little food processor or whatever. And then when you make the holes, this is the night before in the meat. You want about 5 or 6 holes. Stuff that in. And that's just going to give it a little sexiness. And then whatever's left over, you can rub over the meat. Let it sit in the fridge overnight, partially covered. You want some air circulating around it. And then the next day, you rub it, rub the entire surface of it with a bit of salt, pepper, and a little bit of butter or oil. Okay. Even though it's fatty, that's going to give it a nice kind of crustiness. Okay. And then slow roast it. You can sear it if you want to at the end of roasting, but I would slow roast it at around 325. Then that way it'll be the same temperature all the way through, and use an instant reading thermometer. You know, figure out what degree you want it to be for medium rare, for, you know, where it's very pink. You want it maybe 125, 130. And let it rest for at least 10 to 15 minutes after it's done. That's when all the juices settle and it finishes cooking. Don't cut it right away. All the juices end up on the platter.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Have a fabulous trip.
We will. Thank you.
Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Oh, coming off the slopes to the smell of the beef roasting, some drinks waiting, a big fire. I'm there. Well, that's it for today. You have a great Thanksgiving and join us next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this from Robert Brault, who said, "I suppose I'll die without knowing what pumpkin pie tastes like when you have room for it." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, we're doing something important here at The Splendid Table this month. We're partnering with Feeding America to bring assistance to people who are hungry. Hunger happens in every community, rural or urban, and it impacts all of us. When you support The Splendid Table this holiday season, your gift will not only help us produce our program, but will help provide meals to people in need through Feeding America's network of member food banks. In these months of feasting and celebration for many of us, let's remember those who are going without. Visit splendidtable.org to get more information on our partnership with Feeding America, as well as information on anything else you heard here today. We're going to be back next week. Have a great Thanksgiving. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.